Okay, so good morning everybody. I'm Simona Cagliorani, and in this talk I'm going to discuss the importance of C+ emission studies for galaxies at redshift 6 and beyond. The work that I'm going to present you has been done mostly within the cosmology group in Scuola Normale Superiore, with also some external collaborators as Roberto Maiolino and Dominic Rickers, but in particular I would like to acknowledge the work done by Livia Vallini and Andrea Pallottini that were a PhD student in Scuola Normale since up to almost 1 year ago. So the importance of studying C+ emission in redshift 6 galaxies is strictly related with the cosmic reionization process, a process that was driven by the first galaxies formed after the Big Bang and that completed around redshift between 6 and 8, depending on the year of the Planck release. So these high redshift galaxies are generally discovered through the dropout technique. In this case, we talk about Lyman-Bragg galaxies, or through the narrow band technique. And in this case, we talk about Lyman alpha emitters. However, both these techniques are plagued with intrinsic difficulties. For example, for what concerns the Lyman-Bragg galaxies, we have to deal with uncertainties on their redshifts that are typically of the order of 10%. There are also problems with contamination from foreground galaxies and so on. For what concerns the narrowband technique, we have to take into account that Lyman alpha emitters are generally discovered thanks to the fact that their ionizing radiation is forming ionized bubbles that allow Lyman alpha photons to escape. However, when we move towards high redshift, so if the reionization process is not completed, this ionized bubble may be not large enough to allow these Lyman alpha photons to escape. So these difficulties with the general technique used to discover and to characterize high redshift galaxies, combined with the advent of powerful millimeter observatories, has somehow raised the question whether we can look for alternative, as for example, through the C+ emission line. Now, the detection of C+ emission lines is quite common in the local universe. In this figure, you can see the C+ star formation rate relation as observed in local sources, dwarf galaxies with this dark gray region, and the starburst galaxy is a light gray region. In the particular, in this figure, I'm showing the results by Ilse Deluz, and the dwarf data are color-coded according to their metallicity. Now, the fact that the C+ emission line is so bright, in particular consider that it is the strongest emission line emitted in most galaxies. It can account 0.1% of the total far infrared luminosity. And considering this C+ star formation rate relation, have somehow suggested to look for this line even in redshift 6 galaxies that are detectable through the C+ emission line at redshift greater than 4, with, for example, with ALMA. However, the first observational campaigns on the C+ line at this high redshift were unsuccessful. And here in this figure, for example, you can see the observation of the C+ line for Echinico Note that Himiko is the brightest Lyman alpha emitters at redshift 6. Here, for example, you can see the result of IOK, that is another Lyman alpha emitters at redshift around 7. So in these cases, but also these are just two examples, there are basically undetection of the C-plus line in very highly star-forming galaxies. However, very recently, the C-plus line has been instead detected in some galaxies at redshift between 6 and 7. Here you can see the detection of the C-plus line by Maiolino in 2015. Willott in 2015, and certainly the larger sample of C-plus emitters is by Kappa and collaborators always very recently in 2015. So you can see that if you detect the C-plus line, it is exactly along the C-plus star formation rate relation that we observe in the local universe. So basically, like several years ago, so like 5 years ago, we started a project that was meant to simulate the C-plus emission, from high redshift galaxies with the aim of understanding something both from the detection of the C-plus line and the non-detection in these Lyman alpha emitters. So, as already introduced very nicely by Mark Wolfire yesterday, we need to take into account the multiphase structure of the interstellar medium to have a reliable calculation of the C-plus emission, and also we need to take into account molecular clouds. This is what we have started to do with this first work, in which we have used hydroradiative transfer simulation, and we have also considered a subscrid model that allowed to compute both the warm and the cold neutral medium in our simulated galaxies, as well as we have added molecular clouds according to the prescription by Padoan and Nordlund in 2011. So we are considering a redshift 6.6 galaxy that is hosted in a dark matter halo of 10 to the 11 solar masses. And here you can see the result for the warm neutral medium and the cold neutral medium. And here you can see four slices in which the green regions represent the location of molecular clouds. And then we have applied a photodissociation region code that was developed within the Serena VT group to basically compute the C-plus emission line starting from our multi-structured interstellar medium in this galaxy. And here you can see the results obtained as a function of different metallicities and star formation rate values. We can extract a relation between the C-plus luminosity predicted and the star formation rate and the metallicity to apply to compare with the C-plus star formation rate relation that I was showing before. So here you can see the data that I already discussed before compared with several models that we have considered with what I was discussing before. And so basically the first thing that we can infer from the no detection of C-plus emission in these redshift 6 galaxies is that maybe these are galaxies characterized by a low gas metallicity. Consider also that this first exercise was very instructive because we realized that C-plus emission mostly arises from photodissociation region with a fraction of C-plus line arising from the diffuse that is less than 10%. And so this means that there is another possible interpretation of this deficit, and that is that basically it is possible that are the molecular clouds that are responsible for the C-plus emission that are somehow disrupted by stellar feedback. as, for example, as a consequence of photoevaporation. And this scenario would be also consistent with, if we enter in the details of the observation, here you can see that, for example, there is a deficit of C-plus line at the location of the UV emission, while instead the C-plus is detected in a displaced clamp. This is not only found by Maiolino and collaborators, but there are also some similar cases in the sample by Kapak et al. So you can see that there is a deficit in correspondence of the UV emission as here, while the clamp is displaced. So this first part of the work allow us to somehow infer properties from the C-plus line observation from single sources. But as I was saying in the introduction, we also want to understand whether C-plus emission studies are also somehow useful for detecting galaxies responsible for the cosmic reionization. And so in this case, we need a much larger volume for our simulation. In this case, we have used an AMR code, RAMSES, with a 10 megaparsec large box. And in this case, the star formation was a Schmidt-Kennicott was based on a Schmidt-Kennicott recipe. And for what concerns feedback, we just consider thermal feedback from supernovae. So you can see that we can quite well explain the star formation rate evolution with redshift. Here you can see a map of the overdensity, of the metallicity, and of the temperature. Along with these bubbles, you can also find the location of the star-forming regions. And what is nice is that basically for free, we also get the UV luminosity function from these redshift 6 galaxies that is in very nice agreement with the observations. So in this figure, the observations are the blue squared, while our simulation are the red circles. At this point, what we can do is to combine these large-scale simulations with the model of the C-plus emission that I was describing before. This is what we have done, and here you can see an example of a C-plus emission map in which basically we have also convolved our simulation with a typical ALMA beam size of the order of one arcsecond. So the C-plus emission is color-coded according to its intensity per beam, and there are, you can see, some white crosses that indicates the UV magnitude of the galaxies responsible for this emission. So what we can do is also the following. We can compute what is a C-plus MUV relation. Here in this figure, you can see our simulated point with red circles, and these color symbols represent instead the observation of Kapak, Maiolino, and Willott, so the ones in which the C-plus emission was detected. Actually, in our box, we don't have this very large galaxy, but what we can do is to extrapolate what we find in fainter galaxies up to these very bright sources. And you can see that we find a very good agreement once more with the observations, meaning from one side that the Vallini model was providing reliable predictions for the C-plus line, but from the other side, we can also say that the properties of our simulated galaxies in the large box simulation are consistent with observations. However, what I want here also to underline is the following. So we are detecting the C-plus line up to now in galaxies that are brighter than a UV magnitude minus 20. However, we know, or at least the general consensus is that the reionization process is driven by much fainter galaxies. So we have to look for C+ emission in galaxies characterized by UV magnitude minus 19, minus 18. Our predictions say that in these galaxies we would need like 40 hours of ALMA observing times, of 2,000 hours of ALMA observing time for a UV magnitude minus 18, and just to detect the line at 4 sigma. So actually this means that the reionization sources are going to be challenging to detect it with ALMA unless we don't look for lensed galaxies. Okay, so in these last 15 minutes, I would like instead to present another project that concerns the importance of outflows in redshift 6 galaxies. So this was an argument already introduced by Alberto Bolatto yesterday. I want just to briefly remind you that outflows are important to explain the discrepancy between in the low mass tail between the stellar mass function and dark matter halo mass function. They are very important because we know that the intergalactic medium is enriched with metals up to redshift 6 and even beyond. Here you can see an example of a quasar absorption spectrum in a quasar at redshift 6. Also the absorber is at very high redshift. So we need a kind of physical mechanism that is able to drive metals produced in the interstellar medium out to the intergalactic medium. And finally, I would like also to underline the fact that the presence of outflows is particularly important in the case of our reionization sources, meaning small galaxies, because they are generally characterized by shallower potential wells. So specifically in these sources, the outflow can shape the galaxy star formation history, and eventually they can produce like a cavity in the interstellar medium that may allow ionizing photons to escape, thus increasing somehow the efficiency of small galaxies in reionizing the universe. So again, this was something already introduced by Alberto. We have a signature of outflowing gas in a galaxy at redshift 6. This is a quasar host galaxy, J1148, one of the most distant quasar. And so here you can see the C+ emission line as detected by Maiolino in the 2012 and by Claudia Ciccone in 2015. So in these studies, we realized that the C+ emission line profile required a broad component to, here you can see the broad component in both the data. Okay, so the idea was to try doing something similar also in the sample by CAPAC, and in particular, in this case, we are considering only 9 galaxy spectra, because one of these sources is a quasar, and this HZ10 is characterized by a C+ emission line that is not very well centered. So first of all, clearly we look for evidence of a broad component in single sources without finding any strong statistical evidence. So what we decided to do is to stack the 9 galaxy spectra of the CAPAC sample. And in particular, what we have stacked are not the emission line, but the residual of our fitting to this C+ line. So we are considering a single Gaussian model. We are fitting the C+ line with this single Gaussian. And here, for each of the spectrum, in the bottom part of the figure, you can see the residual, namely the difference between the observed spectrum and our model. We have then combined all the residuals, and this is the results that we find. Here you can see that we tentatively detect a flux excess in the stacked spectrum, in the stacked signal at almost 3 sigma. Well, but what is important is that this flux excess is strongly deviating from a standard normal deviate. In fact, what we would expect is that if our single Gaussian model is a good model for the observed data, the combined signal should be basically distributed as noise, as Gaussian. And here instead we have compared the cumulative distribution function of the stacked spectral in, with the magenta line with several CDF obtained in the case of a random standard deviate. And what we find is that there is a strong deviation from a Gaussian distribution. So is this the signature of outflowing gas we were looking for? And to answer this question, we have basically considered different models in different models. First of all, we have considered a double Gaussian profile that would resemble the case, for example, of J1148. But we have also considered the possibility that our data must be fitted with a Gaussian plus something like a satellite. Here in this example, you can see there is a small Gaussian profile close to the main Gaussian line. This was something also that was suggested by the simulated spectrum that I was showing before, that besides the main line, we also 5 minutes? Sorry. We also detect a C-plus line from satellites. And finally, we have considered the possibility of a double horn profile. Also, in fact, it is possible that the C-plus line is characterized by this kind of profile, as, for example, in the case of the block 2016. So basically, what we have done, we have computed like a large sample of synthetic spectra starting from these different profiles, and we have applied to each of these samples the same procedure that we were doing before. So we are just assuming that we don't know the profile of the line. We are just fitting each synthetic spectrum with a single Gaussian profile, and then we have analyzed the residuals as we did in the case of the observed data. And these are the results. So we, in the case of a double Gaussian profile fitted with a single Gaussian, we would expect a flux excess that is of this type, the magenta shaded region. Each of the results are compared with the flux excess that we have detected. So in the upper panel, there is the case of a double Gaussian profile. In the middle panel, there is the case of satellites. And in the bottom panel, there is the case of a double horn profile. From a chi-square analysis, we can definitively exclude the double horn profile. And what we find is that the double Gaussian is instead the favored profile for describing our data. What I also tried to do was to compute something like a loading factor. In this case, I'm just assuming that the ratio between the narrow component and the broad component of my synthetic spectra is a measurement of the loading factor defined as the outflow rate divided by the star formation rate. So I'm saying that the broad component, the flux in the broad component is proportional to the outflow rate, and the flux in the narrow component is proportional to the star formation rate. So here you can see what are the loading factors for our double Gaussian models. And at this point, what we can do is to compare our results with studies of starburst-driven outflows in a sample of close-by starburst galaxy. So in this figure, you can see the loading factor as a function of the star formation rate, the loading factor as a function of the outflow velocity, and the outflow velocity as a function of the star formation rate. I will just focus on this result because it does not depend on my definition of loading factor. That is not precisely what actually people is doing. So consider that the CAPAC sample is characterized by a star formation rate between 5 and 70, so this square, and that the models that I was considered to match the flux excess are characterized by outflow velocities between 100 and 500 kilometers per second. So we are very close to what Heckman was finding. Okay, sorry. So I don't remember what are the difference between the green and the blue, but what I'm showing here is our results compared with what they found. I don't remember the green and blue. I think the yes, see, yes, sorry. So the points are low redshift observations, and the square is basically found according to our model. So 5 minutes, almost done. We have done something even more. We have finally compared these results with the outcomes of a new numerical simulation of what we called Thalia. It is a simulated galaxy obtained with an AMR code, once more Ramses. It is hosted in a dark matter halo of the order of 2 into 10 to the 11. Once more, we have first considered a large box of 20 megaparsec, and then we have zoomed the simulation on a smaller box of the order of 2 megaparsec. Consider that Ramses allows several level of refinement, and we have reached a minimum resolution of 32 parsecs. So this means that in this simulation, we can also follow the physics of molecular clouds. And in fact, in this case, we have considered a star formation recipe that depends on the molecular hydrogen fraction according to the Krumholtz model. We are also considering stellar feedback from supernova explosion, stellar wind, radiation pressure. We end up with a stellar mass of the order of 10 to the 10 solar masses, a molecular mass of 10 to the 8 solar masses, and at redshift 7, this galaxy is characterized by a star formation rate of 100 solar masses per year. So in this figure, you can see zoomed in map of the density, of the temperature, of the pressure, and of the metallicity. So first, there is a large zone that is zoomed really in the center of the galaxy. Note that we are forming a molecular hydrogen disk that is almost 1.5 kiloparsec large. And also, you can notice that the metallicity that we are predicting is quite high, even supersolar, very close to the center of the galaxies, but strongly also depends on the density distribution. In particular here, I'm showing both a map of the density of Dahlia and of the metallicity, in which I'm also overplotting the velocity of the gas particle that are within the simulation. You can see that there are several particles that are going outwards the galaxy, as well as here you can see something. And in particular, what we can do is to compute the probability distribution function of the radial velocities of this particle for different distances from the center of the galaxies. So between 0.1 kiloparsec, we have this distribution, the magenta distribution. We have both outflows and inflows that are characterized by velocities of the order of plus minus 500 kilometers per second. While at 15 kiloparsec from the center of the galaxy, we are just left with a few outflowing particles. So remember that what I was saying before, so that we need a double component as large as 100, 500 kilometers per second to explain the flux excess that we detect in the CAPAC sample. So the comparison with this simulation, it was just to say that outflows are predicted in these high redshift galaxies, and the kind of velocities that we are inferred are not that far from what we expect. So I will just now summarize. I present, first of all, a model in which we predict the C plus star formation relation for high redshift galaxies. And basically, we have used this model to interpret both the detection and the no detection of C plus line in redshift 6 galaxy. For what concerns the non-detection, it is possible that the Lyman alpha emitters, in which the C plus line has not been observed, are characterized by low metallicity values, particularly less than 0.2. Or it is also possible that since we find that most of the C plus emission is arising from PDR, it is also possible that molecular clouds are disrupted by negative stellar feedback. Then we have moved on large scales. Here we have compared the C plus UV magnitude relation observed with our simulation, with our cosmological simulation of metal enrichment by these high redshift galaxies, finding a very good result that is somehow confirming the reliability of our predictions. But we have also somehow realized that the C plus line is very powerful. If we want to characterize the sources that we already know, it is very hard to look for sources of cosmic reionization through C plus emission studies, unless, again, these galaxies are not lensed. And finally, I present what I have called a tentative detection of outflowing gas. We are talking about a 3-sigma signal. However, I found that it was quite interesting that the flux excess that we detect was basically very well explained in the case of a double Gaussian profile for this C plus emission line. So again, we tentatively infer an outflow velocity that is between 100 and 500 kilometers per second, in very good agreement both with observations of local galaxies and with simulations of high redshift galaxies. And I would stop here.
Hi, so I, is it on? Okay. So I have a question about the PDR modeling from the first part of your talk. So you sort of came up with this fitting formula that involved the star formation rate and the metallicity, and I guess I didn't follow. It seems like there must be some dependence on, say, the density or the column density, right? I mean, there must be other parameters going in there. What are they?
Yes, certainly. For each cell of our simulation, we have applied the PDR code. And in each cell, we can compute what is the G-naught that is arriving in our cell. We know the density of the molecular clouds. We know the metallicity. So we have this code that can translate all these properties in C-plus emissivity.
Okay, and the density is just the density at 32, at your 32 parsec resolution. That's what you're putting in for the density?
The density was taken from the log normal distribution of Padoan and Nordlund 2011. So basically, we have our cell. We apply a gene mass criterion. If the cell is characterized by a mass greater than the gene mass, we consider that cell as a molecular part of our galaxy, then we need to know what are the number of molecular clouds within our cell and their density. To do this, we have extracted randomly from the log normal distribution of the Padoan and Nordlund model a large number of molecular clouds up to fill up the volume of our cell. In each of these molecular clouds, we are applying the PDR code. And for each molecular cloud, we know the C-plus emission. We sum up together, and we have this, the C-plus emission for a single cell.
Okay, I had a comment and also a question. The comment's a very minor one, which is just that Himiko isn't the most luminous Lyman alpha emitter. That's CR7. Subsequently CR7.
CR7,
and
sorry.
And last week, Cola 1 from Esther Wu is actually the current leader.
You're right.
I recommend Cola 1, by the way, because it's a very unique and strange Lyman alpha emitter.
Yes. We have sorry if I interrupt you, but we have done a work on this, on the CR7. And because, as you were saying, this is a galaxy characterized by a very zero metal abundance. And so maybe then we can discuss about.
Yeah, Cola 1's even more odd because it actually has a multi-component structure, which I think is the first sort of high redshift object that actually has that in the spectrum, right?
Yes.
And no, because there's no helium observation there. But that was a comment, right? My question was, how sensitive are your results on these outflows to the method that you actually use to fit the Gaussian, right? Because Gaussian fitting is a notoriously uncertain process, right? And in particular, the relative weights of the kind of low flux emission versus the high flux emission, always a very tricky thing to try and decide.
No, yeah, I definitely agree. So what we have tried to do, maybe I have also a figure here, we have used, yes, here you can see, we have used the PDF of the Gaussian peak of the Gaussian RMS width observed to constrain the three models that I'm considering. So the double Gaussian profile, the double horn, and the satellites. Okay, so the three parameters of this model are constrained in such a way that the PDF of our single Gaussian fit is very close to what we find in CAPAC. This is, I mean, the best that we can do. I definitely agree that could be as other possible models, but it was also quite interesting to find that we find a very similar shape in the flux excess to what you would expect from a double Gaussian profile. So. Certainly, we need what we have asked for ALMA time. What we need to do is to detect a broad component in a single galaxy, and then everything would be much clearer. Clearly, we can have specific simulations and so on. So this was just a preliminary studies for outflows in high redshift galaxies.
Yeah, so I have a curiosity about the simulations.
Yes.
Because I've used recently Ramses for completely different purposes. So I was just curious to know if you have some level of internal turbulence in the simulations. And also, I imagine that in this universe, maybe it is not relevant, but also sort of magnetic field.
No. No. Okay. Stuff
because
not
I mean,
considered. Because you what's your experience with this?
These simulations depends a lot on these two ingredients. So.
But maybe on very small scales.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I was just curious to know if this makes a difference.
Our smaller scale is a giant molecular cloud.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So maybe what you are talking about is the.
Yeah, it's of course it is applied inside a denser core, but I was just curious if there is at this level also something about magnetic fields that is not.
At least it was.
Yeah, and another curiosity is about the geometry, because you have shown, I think, a projection, particular projection, or?
Yes, in fact, I did not, because I was mentioning that we find the disk, but I just shown that the face-on part of our molecular hydrogen disk, if you see the edge-on, is like a 200 parsec high, so it's like really a disk. And you can see also some spiral arms, maybe.
Can you go to the last slide, conclusion?
So the summary.
Yeah, conclusion. So technical question, sorry.
Yes.
Having a look to the tentative detection of outflowing gas, it seems that you have used Rabin spectra of around 100 kilometers per second.
Yes.
Yeah, but I mean, Kappa galaxies have got different spectral resolution, and once you Rabin that channels, you got errors. Did you take into account about these errors?
Yes, I take into account that. That's why, for example, in the data that I was showing here. Yes, here. So in this data, you see, I have taken into account both the Rabin channel, as well as the fact that in the high velocity and low velocity channels, we have a small number of galaxies that can be used in the stacking procedure.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
So can you back to the summary slide again?
Yes.
Yeah, that's very nice, you know, summary. So, you nicely show that the deficit of the carbon 2 can be explained with the low metallicity, metallicity less than 0.2 solar metallicity, and also you show the photo evaporation, possibility, and can you quantify how strong radiation field you need in such galaxies? Well, in
to make molecular clouds photoevaporate it.
Right.
Okay.
Right. Like ionization parameter or whatever. Well,
okay. I did not have the time to enter in these details, but what Livia is doing is just a paper that it was just submitted was to compute the how the C+ emission varies as a function of time if you take into account the photoevaporation. And so you can see that the photoevaporation effect is strongly dependent on the metallicity and also strongly dependent on the G0. So clearly, the higher is the G0, the quicker will be the photoevaporation of the cloud, and also the higher is the metallicity, the slower would be the photoevaporation. So here we are considering, it's not simulation, it's just a semi-analytical model, in which basically our giant molecular cloud is considered as the sum of several clumps into a giant molecular cloud. You have an intra-clump medium here, and we have a radius of 16 parsec, a mass of 10 to the 5 solar masses. So what we are doing, we are illuminating this cloud, and we are just computing how the C+ emission would vary if the molecular cloud start being photoevaporated. So, you don't need a very big, maybe greater than 10 to the 2 to start having a strong effect on the molecular cloud photoevaporation.
It's Simona? I'm not terribly familiar with the high redshift observations. Can you explain to me how good a measure of the metallicity we have in those objects? Zero. No,
we don't have. I mean, generally the metallicity is measured through optical lines ratios, And at least in these galaxies, there are not this kind of data. So I mean, I was not mentioning any metallicity inferred from other studies. I was just suggesting that if we don't see C+, maybe it is because the metallicity is low. Come on, Eastern.
In the K-Pax sample, at least you have a fraction of the sources that have far infrared luminosities that have been detected. So this, I mean, points toward the fact that these galaxies at least have, you know,
yes,
at least a fraction of them are chemically mature. And also their inferred beta lobes, although very uncertain, they seem to be, you know, relatively
metal abundant objects.
Reddish compared to other galaxies observed.
Yes, but I mean, if the question is if we can measure the metallicity from other diagnostics, at least in this sample, is no.
It was a great discussion. And the second talk of this morning will be by Ilse Deluz, who will continue talking about fine structure diagnostics of ISM and stuff emission rate.